Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had author and political commentator Ian Williams and writer and economic analyst Charles Orter, both of them from New York. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. New U.S. President Joe Biden signed 17 executive orders just hours after taking office, dismantling decisions made by his predecessor, Donald Trump. China imposes sanctions on what it calls lying and cheating, former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and 27 other top American officials under Donald Trump. The United Arab Emirates reportedly signs an agreement with the United States to purchase 50 F-35 jets and up to 18 armed drones. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's great to have you with us. Our top story this hour, U.S. President Joe Biden has signed 17 executive orders to undo Donald Trump's policies hours after taking office. The orders target the former president's policies on immigration, climate change, racial equity, and the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The actions initiate the process of the United States rejoining the Paris Climate Accord and include the revocation of the presidential permit granted for a controversial oil pipeline. In another order, Biden ended a travel ban Trump put in place on some Muslim-majority countries. The new president has also made compulsory wearing masks in all federal buildings and land. The president's move comes following his inaugural address in Washington, D.C.
We'll press forward with speed and urgency, for we have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities. Much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Few people in our nation's history have been more challenged or found a time more challenging or difficult than the time we're in now.
In his inaugural address at the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., Biden expressed concerns over the rise in political extremism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism. He pledged to be a president for all Americans and said he would seek unity
Biden takes office at a moment of profound challenges he is facing at home and abroad. The swearing-in ceremony ended Donald Trump's turbulent 4 years in office. However, at a farewell speech at a military base, Trump defended his much-criticized policies, saying his term was incredible and that his administration accomplished a lot.
What we've done has been amazing by any standard. We rebuilt the United States military. We created a new force called Space Force. That in itself would be a major achievement for a regular administration. We were not a regular administration.
Trump also vowed to stay in the spotlight, promising his supporters he will be back in some form. The outgoing president did not explicitly concede the election, but wished the new administration great luck and great success. However, he skipped the inauguration of successor Biden in an extraordinary break with tradition. Joe Biden is sworn in as the new U.S. president, replacing the polarizing and precedent-shattering Donald Trump. But he has inherited a country struggling with racial, financial, political, and cultural challenges. Rami Mazahari has more from Chicago.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as president of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden's being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. Unless of course there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless of course there's pressure from the left, like I said, the role of labor, to actually pressure to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes that could improve the quality of life immediately, materially for working people, then I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about Biden is talking about return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest-ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The new White House press secretary says the United States seeks to lengthen and strengthen the nuclear constraints on Iran through diplomacy. Jen Psaki said President Joe Biden would engage in early talks with allies to pursue restraints on Iran's nuclear program. She added that Iran must resume compliance with significant limitations under the 2015 nuclear deal known also as the JCPOA. Former President Donald Trump abandoned the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has said Washington did not face a quick decision on whether to rejoin the nuclear agreement. earlier Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said the ball is in America's court to return to the accord. He emphasized that Iran would only start to act on its commitments when Washington starts carrying out its obligations. Sejiro Takashita is a professor of management at the University of Shizuoka and joins us now. Professor, welcome. So it does appear that the new White House is imposing conditions on returning to the Iran nuclear deal, something that Tehran has said is a red line.
Well, I think it's not only Iran and United States. I mean, this Iran nuclear deal really involves the Europeans in particular, I feel. And I think Mr. Trump was trying to get his strength or basically show off his strength by butting into this, you know, Iranian deal and basically putting, you know, Europeans in jeopardy. Because before, you know, 2018, after this agreement was fixed, you can see that the trade with Iran and France has tripled. And Germany has made also very heavy investment, as well did the Great Britain. So you can see the Europeans were already very willing and happy to, you know, make all the businesses with Iran. And this is where Mr. Trump had to, well, basically get in and swirl things around when things were going on the right direction. So I would say that, you know, at least we're going on the normal path, or I say to the path of normalization as far as relationship is concerned.
Right. Iran and the U.S. have not always seen eye to eye. And that's a bit of an understatement. So when it comes to the deal itself, the JCPOA, all the other signatories have said that you're either in or you're out. So if the United States is out, if it sets these conditions of which the United of which Iran will not accept, if it's out, for example, the EU foreign policy chief today said at least remove the secondary sanctions. Do you think the new administration would go down that path?
At least a new administration will be on the table to negotiate. Now that is a world of difference compared to the previous, you know, president's, you know, delegates. So yes, you know, there could be some disagreement, and it's fine to agree to disagree. At least you're on the table, and that's what I mean by going in the right direction. Because obviously, the two parties, especially the Iranians and the Americans, as you just said, the governments don't look eye to eye, to say the least. But, you know, if you don't get onto the, you know, the negotiation table, nothing will advance. And we may have third-party, you know, litigations that might come along. It could be in the Europeans that I was talking about. It could be other form of soft pressure that would enable the two parties to at least reach an agreement. And that, in my opinion, is a world of difference.
Right. Okay, Sejiro, thank you very much indeed. Sejiro Takashita, a professor of management, joining us out of the from the University of Shizuoka and out of the Japanese city of Shizuoka. Now, Democrats seize control of the U.S. Senate as new Vice President Kamala Harris swears in three senators hours after taking office. John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won the Georgia runoff elections earlier this month, wresting two seats from Republican Senator Alex Padilla from California. Also took Kamala Harris's seat. Both Democrats and Republicans now hold 50 seats in the Congress's upper chamber, but the vice president's vote can break the tie in favor of the Democrats. The two chambers of Congress are now controlled by Democrats, a development which is expected to help President Joe Biden enforce his policies. Staying in the U.S., where the COVID-19 death toll has surpassed the total American military fatalities from World War II, the Johns Hopkins University reported that nearly 406,000 people have died from the disease caused by the new coronavirus in the United States. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the total number of combat and non-combat deaths in the Second World War was almost 405,400. The U.S. is the worst hit country in the world by the virus, with more than 24.4 million cases. And the United Arab Emirates has reportedly signed a deal with the U.S. for 50 F-35 fighter jets, despite concerns about the Arab country's involvement in a deadly and devastating war on Yemen. Reports said the agreement was signed about an hour before President Joe Biden was sworn into office. The UAE also signed a separate agreement to buy up to 18 armed drones. However, the new US president has said he will re-examine the agreement. The administration of former President Donald Trump had approved $23 billion in stealth-capable F-35 jets, Reaper drones, and other weapons to its Persian Gulf ally after it agreed to recognize Israel. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been engaged in the years-long war on Yemen, which faces the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Supporters of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement have held a demonstration in the capital Sana'a against the U.S. decision to designate the group as a terrorist organization. The movement said in a statement that it is, quote, ready to take all necessary measures against any hostile act. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's administration announced the move on January the 11th. The United Nations and aid groups have warned that the designation risks worsening an already dire humanitarian crisis in the Arab country. Yemen's war has killed tens of thousands, displaced millions, and, according to the UN, left 16 million on the brink of famine.
Ansar Allah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurous policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansar Allah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation. The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students, who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sana'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansar Allah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansar Allah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansar Allah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country. Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansar Allah movement is an unacceptable move, prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Elsewhere now, French President Emmanuel Macron has refused an official apology for colonial-era abuses in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be, quote, no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the bloody eight-year war that ended French rule there. The presidency also said the French leader would instead take part in symbolic acts aimed at promoting reconciliation. The statement came ahead of the publication of a major report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. During Algeria's independence war against the colonial ruler, more than 1.5 million Algerians were killed. France has already acknowledged that it was responsible for systematic torture during the war. Political commentator Faraz Al-Najm says the atrocities of colonial France in Algeria should be counted as genocide.
It's very biased compared to how they treated the Armenian, for instance, genocide, as they called it, right? And they had statements coming out of a lot of the European countries and North American countries and, you know, continuously commemorating it, continuously condemning the Ottoman Empire and, you know, always talking about this in media. And, you know, why not the equality, I mean, here, right? If we have a million people that died during the colonizing time and also the 8-year war, you know, that ended not too long ago in 1962. So the French system itself, like right now, Macron also, you know, he went further even by disrespecting the Muslims not too long ago. And the Algerians are Muslim people. So this shows there is maybe an Islamophobic nature. If not, it's clear. For me, it's crystal clear. But so for other people, they should look into this, that there is, you know, this inequality. If a Muslim gets killed, tortured, it's fine. It's acceptable. But when, for instance, a Christian or another type of ethnicity or something like that, you know, based on their agenda, that is a big human rights crime. That is a big, you know, problem, and that we have to fix this, and we have to, you know, mainstream it and make sure that it's very much highlighted. So there must be major changes that have to be done, and people need to hold these countries and these systems and these administrations accountable.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household.
and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
President Trump authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Donald Trump, whilst in office, to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane. Mr. Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Goldman. The piece is titled, Trump Approves Document Disclosures in Apparent Bid to Taint Russia Investigation. Stay with us for more of Adam Goldman's article. President Donald Trump has authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Mr. Trump, while in office, to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation, known as Crossfire Hurricane. Donald Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials in FBI who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. No documents were immediately released, and it was not clear what material Donald Trump declassified or why he waited until the final hours of his presidency to do so. He said there was a binder with materials on the investigation. I determined that the materials in that binder should be declassified to the maximum extent possible, Donald Trump wrote in a memo to the Attorney General and the Directors of National Intelligence and the CIA that was released by the White House. He had accepted some redactions. The White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had also long attacked the investigation and pressed for the release of more information and documents whilst in his previous role as a congressman. While Mark Meadows served as Donald Trump's top aide, the White House repeatedly declassified documents in an apparent effort to taint Crossfire Hurricane, drawing condemnations that the administration was politicizing intelligence. Career intelligence officials objected to the move, concerned that it would jeopardize intelligence gathering and sources of information. The review by the Justice Department's Independent Inspector General determined that investigators had sufficient reason to open the Russia inquiry and found no evidence that political bias played a role in the move. Meanwhile, President Trump delivered a defiant and unapologetic farewell speech to the nation in a video released on Tuesday, 19th of January, declaring that he took on the toughest battles and vowing that the movement we started is only just beginning. Donald Trump, who has not appeared in public in days and remained in seclusion at the White House in his final hours in office, sought to frame his administration as a period of progress, despite the coronavirus pandemic that has now killed 400,000 Americans and the divisions that led to the storming of the Capitol building this month by a mob of his supporters. "I did not seek the easiest course of action," Donald Trump said in the 20-minute video posted online the day before he leaves office. "By far, it was actually the most difficult. I did not seek the path that would get the least criticism. I took on the tough battles, the hardest fights, the most difficult choices, because that's what you elected me to do. Your needs were my first and last unyielding focus. This, I hope, will be our greatest legacy." Trump made no explicit concession to President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., nor did he mention his name. After months of falsely claiming that he did not lose the election and trying to overturn the results of the election, Donald Trump has scorned the traditional transition of power, refusing to invite Joe Biden for the customary post-election visit to the White House, and opting to skip the inaugural ceremony on Wednesday, 20th of January. In his farewell speech, Donald Trump also condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol building without acknowledging any responsibility for encouraging his supporters to take such action, for which he has been impeached by the House and faces trial by the U.S. Senate. "All Americans were horrified by the assault on our Capitol," he said. "Political violence is an attack on everything we cherish as Americans. It can never be tolerated." Likewise, as the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic reached a macabre new benchmark, Trump offered no regrets about his handling of the virus, which he repeatedly dismissed and said would simply disappear. He claimed credit for the record-fast development of vaccines, though, which even some opponents have praised him for, but made no mention of the troubles that have slowed the distribution of the vaccines.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Israel, unpunished child killers.
The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair,
especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. The number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief.
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed Al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharman Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western school at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and everything, that it is should be a safe place, that you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information in real time, we were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe, all of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on, and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines fell to the ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Odwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ashifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestine were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated, you know, what happened in Beit Hanun school. It is a message, you know, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at the school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at the school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.
On July 16th, 2004, Ismail was sitting with his cousins. I told them that it was Ramadan and that they shouldn't be playing football and bothering the neighbors. The street is too narrow to play football. It's 2 meters wide, which is not enough room. All of us here are brothers and cousins. We live in a sector of homes the size of 1 square kilometer, which houses 1,000 people thereabouts. Ismail said he was going to play outside with his cousins. It was sunny and hot, so they went to the beach to play as they often do. It's not far, and it's the only suitable place to play, next to the part of the beach reserved for swimming.
Stay in here, son. There's shelling outside. He said he wanted to go to his uncle's house to play with their kids.
Ahid is my one and only grandson. He came after 9 granddaughters. Zakaria, my beloved son, the youngest. He was spoiled. He was my entire life. Whenever his father asked him, "Who loves you?" he always said, "He loves me."
I am accompanied by Al Said, Hamada, Yunus, Ismail, Ahid, and Muhammad, and we're heading now to the spot where we used to play as kids. We are fishermen, and so the sea is our life. We are always on the sea.
The Bak family is a renowned family. We're known to be fishermen by trade. We inherited that from our fathers and from their forefathers who inherited it from Sheikh Bak. The sea is life and breath to us. When our children want to play, they go to the beach.
We set up the goals here and divided ourselves into four teams, and we played football. The boys said they're thirsty. They wanted to go drink some water and come back. I took them to get some water, and when we came back...
We resumed and finished the first round. In the middle of the second round, Ismail kicked the ball and it landed next to the container. We asked him to go get it. He brought it back, along with Mortazim, Zachariah, Ahid, and Muhammad.
The warships were there. We saw that they were filming us. They sent a missile to the beach, and it wiped out my cousin. The first missile landed there, killed my cousin Ismail, and we started running to get off the beach.
The rest of the group came running toward us. We saw them, but Ismail wasn't with them. Bashir Abu Watfa was standing there. When he heard the explosion, he came out from the tent. He stood by us while we told him that Ismail was killed. The other children reached us.
They fired a second missile, and it landed here.
We decided, Hamada, Yunus and I, to hide behind the tent. Muntasir was on the ground. They fired another missile at us as we fell behind the tent. Yunus hid in a barrel while Hamada and I kept running. Muntasir ran with us. Hamada and Montasir entered the tent seconds after us. Bashir Abu Watfa was crying out, "O people, help us. The children are dead. The children are dead."
Four of those eight kids were basically vaporized when the bombs hit. Their young bodies could not be identified or even found amongst the debris left behind. The other four dispersed in different directions, not knowing the fate of each other, as more bombs actually followed them. Ambulances and journalists came, but it was all over.
Badly wounded, I crawled until I reached help. Someone laid me on the ground and left to bring an ambulance. They wrapped my head in a bandage and laid me down. I was in a coma, so at the time, I didn't know who was killed and who was still alive.
They laid Montasim by a wall, thinking he was dead. Hamas fainted. Yunus sat next to his brother, and I was weeping over my brother and cousins.
This other boy was with them. He came over yelling, "Mama, Mama." I said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "Muhammad was martyred." I said, "How come Muhammad was martyred? Are you sure? You must be lying because Muhammad was here just now." He said that Muhammad was killed. I said he wasn't. But then I saw it air on TV, children killed on the beach. The girls cried. "He was our son of 20 years. We cry over you every day, son. You are never out of our thoughts."
Each day since the day Ismail was martyred, I have gone to the beach to spot where he was killed, and I've searched for his remains, hoping the sea had washed them up. I remembered that day vividly. When I reached the hospital, I realized what I had witnessed, a massacre against humanity. Where is the humanity? Ismail's senseless murder has forever taken the smile and joy from my home.
Zakaria, Ahid, and Mortazim, who was injured but thought to be dead. Ismail and all of our kids were dead. I would not wish this on anyone. Everyone saw us on TVs and internet. What can I possibly say? I say occupation took my first grandson, who called me grandma.
The survivors of that tragic day come back to the beach, not to play as they did before, but to sit, to remember, vainly searching for a rational reason to an irrational act. It was a blatant war crime, which claimed the lives of their four relatives, with no one thus far held accountable. Meanwhile, they suffer from physical injuries themselves and the psychological trauma of it all.
Life without them is meaningless and full of despair. I'm not saying that because they are my brothers, but for the sake of all Palestinians, all of children. If I was flying a jet and I saw Jewish children playing, I wouldn't target them because they are just children playing. They could see from after that we were children.
They could tell we were a bunch of kids playing. They deliberately target and kill the children of Gaza and Palestine. They want to uproot them at a young age so they won't grow up and become resistors. So they bomb them at this young age.
Incredibly, shockingly, the targeting of Palestinian children escalated and peaked on the day of Eid al-Fitr, when the children of Gaza came out to play, to lighten up, relax, and have some fun to celebrate the last day of Eid, thinking that the Israeli army would not dare to violate such a holy occasion. Israel unmercifully sent missiles down, turning their brief period of joy to incomprehensible grief.
We live in Al-Ahrar Street at the beach camp, a major street in the camp area. We awoke on the day of Eid to enjoy it like everyone else normally does. The children were playing in the street, some were playing on the swings. All of a sudden, a missile landed on top of us. It was around 3 p.m. We were surprised by the explosion, but when we turned around, we saw the children had become shreds of flesh laying in the street. Some were injured and some others were dead.
I was playing on the swings when the missile landed. I got hit with shrapnel here. Some people were killed. My uncle Shaban, Jamal, and Muhammad were among those who died. I remember we were happy and playing on the day of Eid. Who could be so wicked as to bomb us on such a holy day? The children were out playing and rejoicing. And then the missile came, and in a second they were dead. Shaban had been blown apart. Others who died were Muhammad al-Halou, the Barit family's son, Muhammad Biqdad, and Muhammad Washah.
Muhammad Biqdad, Muhammad Washah. كان في كثير شهداء مرميين.
There were many martyrs, some scattered around on the ground, inside buildings, in trees, everywhere. The injured and the dead. Ambulances and cars swarmed on the location, and people were crying out in anguish for the loss of their children. 13 martyrs and 40 to 50 injuries. I sustained injuries to my leg here. And in my chest here. My grandfather took my cousin and I to the ambulance.
رحنا على المستشفى. ابني كان يلعب ورا السيارة كان جنبي يعني تقريبا.
My son was playing behind the car. He was almost next to me, but he died due to bleeding caused by a shrapnel penetrating his body. When the missile first landed, I was still conscious, receiving wounds to my stomach, legs, and arms. My leg disabled and my arm was broken and behind my back. I wore a white top which was covered in blood. I looked around just before I fainted to see the extent of the brutality and carnage. The scene was horrific, their actions so brutal.
أنا عن جد أقسم بالله إشي وحش جدا جدا إجرام بمعنى الكلمة.
Martyrs came from several refugee families at the beach camp on the first day of Eid after being targeted by an Israeli bombing campaign. On the third day of Eid, missiles of the Israeli occupation forces targeted some little kids who were playing with their grandfather with some simple new toys they had received for Eid on the roof of their home.
A truce was declared on television on the third day of Eid. We went up on the roof with all the little children. They wanted to play because it was a time of truce. They were not allowed to go out in the street because we worried about their safety.
بعد صلاة العصر حوالي بنص ساعة ساعة إلا ربع.
After 30 to 45 minutes of afternoon prayer, we heard more explosions. There was a first, second, and third explosion. It took some minutes to work out what had happened. Our house was filled with heavy smoke, and we realized that it was actually our house that had been bombed by an Israeli airstrike.
We rushed to the roof only to see the most horrifying scene. All that remained of the elderly man and the seven children that were playing were pieces of flesh and bone. At least three had their heads blown off. I looked over the martyred children. Two of my daughters were among the victims. One had survived. She had a hole in the back of her skull. Another girl was also alive, but couldn't talk. I called her and she looked up at me, so I rushed them to the hospital.
I searched around to collect my children. First I took Abd al-Halim, then I went back inside and got Abd al-Aziz. His head had been split open. I couldn't remove my third daughter. I couldn't find her head. Then I came downstairs and stood here at the doorstep. They took away the bodies of the martyrs in ambulances. I wanted to see whether they took the body of my daughter or not. I found my niece Malik, the daughter of Jalal. I kissed her forehead and I was about to leave with the ambulance. As I was stepping out of the ambulance, a rocket from an unmanned drone hit us. My leg was hit and had to be amputated. This finger and my arm were injured too. It was a cruel airstrike. In all, there were 10 martyrs from my family, including 7 children, my parents, my brother and his daughter, and my cousin who was carrying the bodies of martyrs at the time he was hit.
After the disproportionate aggression on the population of Gaza, there are still survivors today who suffer heightened psychological effects, reflected clearly in their behavior, which is especially telling during play activities such as painting that express the evil acts of Israel perpetrated against them.
Usually after the therapy process and even after recovery, there will still be some trauma symptoms among the affected children, with most of them on edge, in high alert mode, expecting more attacks on them. That's why you find that whenever a child is playing or drawing, the played-out theme tends to represent the incident, which is causing the alerted state from their memories, from their nightmares. When we spoke to children aged around 12 who survived the last three wars, who witnessed and suffered trauma from the 2008 Israeli-imposed war and this one in 2014, after recovering from each war and after being treated, they still believed that there would be another war and another. three wars lived through by a child. The trauma is unimaginable, and the child is left in a state of constant alertness. We can't even tell them that they are safe, that there will be no more wars, or that everything is now fine.
Whenever they unleash a war on us, we will resist and defeat them.
It is beyond any reasonable doubt that targeting children of Palestine is part of the culture and a systematic issue of the Israeli occupation army, which seeks to brand the conscious mind of all Palestinian children with the ideology that they are all the undeserved, the subhuman, that there can be no Palestinian flag, no independence, no resistance.
In the limelight.
As Brexiteers turn on each other, Brexit politics moves fast. Until now, the Tories plan to move on, only reviving Brexit-done triumphalism to re-arouse the captured red wall at the election. Labour just wanted to bury the whole issue. We now present you an article written by Polly Toynbee under the heading, Brexiteers are waking up to the damage they've done. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Polly Toynbee's article. Brexit has breached the fishing boats at Hastings, a seaside town and borough in East Sussex on the south coast of England. The two-man crew of Paul Joy's boat, Kaya, have left for shore jobs after the price of the Hastade land fell to just 2 pence a kilo. Exports to the European Union are Brexit blighted, with fishers across Britain pulled axe by the new costs and regulations. Their catches rotting before they reach the European Union markets. It's costing them millions of pounds already.